In early March 2020, it was clear that Ireland would soon be in the throes of the COVID-19 pandemic. The National Public Health Emergency Team, NPHET, chaired by the Chief Medical Officer, recognised that mathematical and statistical modelling skills were essential to make difficult decisions. Welcome to the Research Impact podcast series. I'm your host, Helena Lenihan, Chair of the University of Limerick's Research Impact Committee. In this episode, we will meet an award-winning research team whose work directly impacted Ireland's response to the global pandemic. I'm really delighted to introduce the team from MACSI. MACSI is the Mathematics Applications Consortium for Science and Industry and is a research centre based here at UL. MACSI is the winner of the University of Limerick's President's Research Excellence and Impact Award for Outstanding Research Collaboration 2022. MACSI has a long history of collaborating with academic, community, and industrial partners to tackle real-world problems using mathematical and statistical modelling to design, amongst many other things, a green roof for Ireland, predicting bus time arrivals, to pouring the perfect cup of coffee. MACSI is based in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics and has been identified as an international exemplar in the Bond Report, which is an independent UK review of knowledge exchange in mathematical sciences. The Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group was established in March 2020 to provide expert advice and forecast models to Ireland's Chief Medical Officer and also to the National Public Health Emergency Team on COVID-19 responses. MACSI's Professor James Leeson is a leading member of the Modelling Advisory Group and was supported by the broader team in MACSI throughout this collaborative response effort. Joining us for today's podcast, we have my esteemed colleagues from MACSI, Professor James Leeson, Professor Cathal Walsh, Professor Norma Bargary, Dr. Amina Gaburu, Dr. James Sweeney, and Dr. David O'Sullivan. Also joining us today is Professor Philip Nolan, Chair of the Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group and a member of NPHET, and of course, current Director General of Science Foundation Ireland. You're all really welcome. Really great to have you all here today. And first of all, congratulations to MACSI. Great achievement.
Thanks, Helena.
So I might kick off maybe the questioning with James and Norma, if you don't mind. Really curious, and I'm sure our listeners will be, to hear about MACSI a little bit and how you responded to this COVID-19 pandemic.
Okay, thanks, Helena. Yeah, MACSI's been around a long time. MACSI actually stands for the Mathematics Applications Consortium for Science and Industry. That acronym is not my fault. That was my colleague, Professor Stephen O'Brien, who invented MACSI or started MACSI back in 2006 through the largest grant ever awarded to mathematics in Ireland, $4.4 million awarded from SFI back in 2006. MACSI was founded with the goal of applying mathematical modelling to the real world. And back in 2006 in particular, that was a fairly innovative idea in Ireland in particular. The idea that mathematics could be used in the real world and in particular used in real world problems, which come from industry or from science or from engineering. So back in 2006, it started. I arrived here in 2007. Myself and Stephen O'Brien were co-directors of MACSI for many years. And during that time, MACSI has gone from strength to strength, various sources of funding. We've worked with many industry partners on problems through our study groups with industry. And I suppose we've built a network of collaborations, both national and international as well over that time, which are crucial to us. We've also seen the emphasis move from mathematics per se to data to and within the discipline we'd be talking more about statistics than applied mathematics. So in the last few years we've noticed that in particular, and we've now running a large scale PhD program in collaboration with colleagues in UCD and Maynooth in PhD program in foundations of data science. And my colleague Norma Bargary, who's here, is now our professor of data science and statistical learning. And we've recognized the importance of that so much that Norma has now become the co-director in my place of MACSI. So herself and Stephen O'Brien are the co-directors of MACSI. And maybe Norma could better talk a little bit about the collaboration and so on that MACSI has engendered in that space.
Yeah, Norma, if you could also maybe talk us through, you know, how did the great work then, how was it in a position to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic?
Sure. So as James mentioned, MACSI has a very long history in applied mathematical modelling and more recently, I suppose, merging that component with statistical modeling. That's been really our USP in Maxi for quite a while now. How do we look at different problems through a variety of lenses from the mathematical side and the statistical side? And then I suppose the real innovation is when those two meet. So as you mentioned, we've had a long history of working in interdisciplinary teams through our contacts in industry and our academic collaborators nationally and internationally. So it was really through one of those collaborators, our colleague, Professor Brendan Murphy in UCD, who was among the first, I suppose, to be in the room when the IMAG team were starting to be put together, that James and Maxi more broadly became involved in the COVID-19 modelling efforts.
So I think we're really interested in how did you get in a position from looking at maths and stats in the real world and then applying it to something that we were all talking about, COVID, R numbers, all of these different things?
Well, I guess a lot of the mathematical modelling and statistical modelling tools that we'd be developing are almost application agnostic. We can use the same kinds of tools to answer lots of different questions. So while we mightn't have direct expertise maybe in epidemiological modelling, James would have a lot of expertise in disease spread and how that works through network modelling, etc. So all of that expertise combined then allowed us to apply that knowledge and that expertise to the COVID space.
Norma's right. Of course, it's really the development of skills that Maxi has done over the years that's really important. That and the collaboration network. So she mentioned Brendan Murphy in UCD, who Norma had worked with closely before, and who, when asked who in the country can help out in this crisis time in a sort of a space where mathematical / statistical modelling is going to be important, knew that Maxi were a good team to come to. So that's been really important to us. And indeed, that collaboration with Brendan and others, Brendan was on IMAG, along with, I suppose, there were five of us on that team who were heavily involved in the hands-on application of modelling. Myself and Carl Walsh from UL, leading the Maxi group, I suppose, input. Brendan Murphy in UCD, Jim Duggan in Galway, and Chris Brunston in Maynooth. So they're all people that we know and have worked with on other aspects and other projects over the years as well. So that collaboration piece is already well established, which is one of the reasons I think that IMAG worked as well as it did.
So now that we've heard all about IMAG from Norma and James, Philip, first of all, great to have you here today. But we're really curious, as I'm sure the listeners will be, how in God's name did IMAG come about? How did it all come into being?
First of all, it wasn't in God's name. It was in the name of the chief medical officer and their different instantiations. So it's interesting, like in and this wouldn't be unique to our country. I think in any small country faced by an emergency like this, you simply have to mobilize the people and the talent that you have. And it's often done through networks of collaboration and engagement that already existed. And in very simple terms, I think it was the 8th of March, 2020, the chief medical officer, Tony Hullin, he and I graduated together from UCD Medical School in 1991, that long ago. And he called me at 8:30 on a Sunday morning to say, do we have anybody in this country who does the mathematical modeling of infectious disease? And that kind of set in train. And he reached out to me as, at the time, university president, that I might know people who did this. And at that point, Brendan Murphy became involved. I would have known Brendan from UCD. Breda Smith, interesting, who is now the chief medical officer, was then director of public health in the West. And she knew Jim Duggan in Galway, who became a member. So we simply started calling people that we knew had expertise in biostatistics and modelling. And that was how we got in touch with James. James was recommended, I think, through Brendan, as I think also was Norma. So it was simply tapping into the networks we have. Who do we have that might be able to help? And the rest, in a way, is history. It grew very quickly to 30 or 40 people, with a core of, I think, about 10 or 15 doing the heavy lifting, so to speak, and building the models, and others playing really important advisory roles. I wouldn't want to diminish the role of any individual, because in our role in advising government, it was often a small insight from a member of the team into a phenomenon or how you might describe it or explain it that made a big difference in the policymaking room and was important as the big work done by people actually building the models. It was very eclectic, and many people who became core to the response, their core expertise wasn't in infectious disease modeling, but the interesting thing was they had deep expertise in applied mathematics or biostatistics, which could be applied. And I don't think it's arrogant to say in some cases, as a result, we got better models than the standard models, if I can put it that way, simpler, more agile, because you were talking about people who really knew what they were doing when it came to mathematical modeling. And for them, this was a new and very important application of the work, but maybe not one that they've been particularly familiar with before.
Really interesting, Philip. Thanks for sharing that with us. I suppose some of the key things that come out when you talk about it are words like collaboration, research informing policy, the rigor and the relevance. Do you think that this is something that is more appreciated by government now about this notion of research informing policy?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. And almost it's an opportunity. This was, and I guess one shouldn't talk about a tragedy like this, but it was also an opportunity for the system to demonstrate its value. And it demonstrated in the whole higher education and research system to demonstrate its value. And it demonstrated its values in kind of ways one mightn't have predicted. So the ways in which people in general understood and engaged in ways to mitigate the spread of the virus, up to and including the extraordinary uptake of a vaccination program, I think you can trace that back to us having a highly educated, highly engaged population who are, you know, interested in understanding scientific and political concepts. The other thing that's really important, I think, is it also emphasizes the importance of having this talent base in the country, again, in areas that you wouldn't necessarily in advance have predicted that you would need it. You know, veterinary infectious disease epidemiology, applied maths and statistics, geocomputation. In one sense, we felt all of these things are important, but the interesting thing is having that broad, raw talent base. When you're faced with a completely unanticipated challenge, you can rely on that to be agile and adapt to the challenge. So it reinforces those kind of two big things, the real value of education and research as a system, the need for breadth and talent when you're dealing with a wicked problem. And then you're absolutely right to layer on top of that the importance of building collaborative networks. Like a lot of the people that we pulled together knew each other and had worked together and had effective working relationships because, for instance, of collaborative research funding that they had received over the years. And then you're absolutely right. Like the government, a senior civil servant did say to me in the last 9 months, kind of jokingly, like they're addicted to data now. And that's a good place for a government to be. You know, they want to see the data before they make decisions. Policy decisions require a very broad range of quantitative and qualitative and kind of structured and intuitive inputs to make them. But the fact that the political system has an administrative system have really come to understand how they can rely on quantitative thinking to approach difficult problems is new, I think, or sort of reinforced, might be a better way to put it, by the pandemic. They're used to thinking about it in economics. They're used to thinking about it in terms of climate, perhaps. But the many other problems that we face, I think we could expect to see the state take a more quantitative approach in the future as to how it thinks through possible scenarios into the future.
Okay, maybe we can pick up on that in a moment. I think I have two takeaways so far. The notion of never waste a good crisis, which I don't think we did. And the other thing, I love this idea of addiction to data. So now that we're addicted to data and there's loads of these societal or grand challenges out there, and you've alluded to that there, you know, do any ideas kind of spring to mind about how we could use modeling approaches to address certain grand societal or these kind of mission-oriented challenges that are out there?
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast by David Spiegelhalter and talking about statistical education. And in fact, he wasn't so sure we needed statistical education. It was us as the presenters of complex concepts to people that needed to rethink. So I think the biggest thing is, and I go back to that example of climate modeling. So I have no doubt that in many of the complex challenges that we face, that kind of rigorous models of varying levels of complexity, I'd argue there's always a place for starting with the simple model and then layering greater degrees of complexity into it at a later stage for lots of reasons that people on the call will be able to explain better than me. But I think the big thing that we need to think about is how do we present those? How do we make them useful to the policymaker? You know, so we have so much information about possible scenarios for climate. How much of an impact is that modeling having on people's thinking, on people's sense of responsibility of where things are actually going to go, and on the political decision-making and direction? And if it's not having impact, I think we need to think about, well, then how persuasive are we with those models? How much use are we making of them? Rather than thinking, well, you know, what do we need to do to educate people out there in order that they can absorb them? What is our approach effective? I think that's the big reflection I'd have over the thing I learned most about in part, like in the IMAG group, I was learning about the technical utility and limitations of the model we were using. Outside the group, I was learning, how do you actually make these useful for people who are making decisions? And how do you really come to a common understanding of what they're telling you, and keep one's attention on what's emerging in that conversation and that understanding?
Obviously, we're technical experts and we learned a lot about communication and talking to the public in general from watching Philip in action. So we sat in the weekly meetings and talked about the data and the technical aspects of the modeling. Philip had to absorb that and then bring that to Cabinet, to NEFIT, and communicate it. So that, I must say, that was a real learning for all of us, to watch that in action and to find ways of taking very technical concepts and to try and drill it down into a way that is both understandable and yet still true to help enable policymaking.
Might take a just a different tack on this one now and come back to you, James. As we said in our sitting rooms every night, everybody was listening to this notion of the R number. And my understanding is that, you know, you've developed a model, SEIR model or something like that, to look at this. But can you explain to us how this model worked and how did we get this R number that we all became obsessed with? Was it, I think, greater than one or less than one or something like that every evening?
Yeah, the R number is a I suppose, a standard measure in epidemiology. It basically tells you whether how many extra cases you expect for each positive case in the population. So one person gets the virus, how many secondary cases do we expect to result from that within a certain interval of time? It can be studied in many ways and it can be looked at in many ways. So statistically, it's really a statistical question. What's the data telling us about that? Is R bigger than one? Is the disease growing across the population or is it less than one? Is it decreasing? The work that we had was taking what's called an SEIR model and using that, calibrating that to the data, again, in close collaboration with our statistician colleagues, because it's not just a mathematical question, as Norm was saying earlier. It's the interplay between the mathematics and statistics is crucial to, because all the data is uncertain and was particularly so, I suppose, in terms of what we were seeing during the pandemic. So taking that information that we have available, allowing for the fact that it is uncertain, and then translating that uncertainty into what the model tells us the effective R number currently is. And we had multiple ways of calculating the R number because there are multiple types of models like that. And again, part of the communication skill is to boil that down to a way that explains the uncertainty while still trying to be clear as to what the most likely outcome is from the modeling point of view.
And now that we have that model, can it be used for other things or could it be adopted again in the future?
Yeah, our model, the SEIR model, is a population-based model. So as Philip said, it's in many ways, it's the simplest possible model that can be used for the purpose that was needed at the time. It forms the basis of more complex models that are currently running and being used. So we had an agent-based model from Liz Hunter in TU Dublin, who was on IMAG. Jim Duggan in Galway built an age-structured model. So the basic SEIR model treats everyone in the population basically as the same. So each person contributes in the same way to the susceptible or the exposed or the infected or the recovered compartment. So we're just talking about where people are in terms of progression of disease. When you include age structure, for example, you're also accounting for the fact that people in the population are of different ages and people of different ages mix differently. So kids tend to mix more with kids and not so much with older adults. And that can be important in certain aspects of modeling disease spread. So we went with the simplest model that would work in terms of what we needed it to do. And that, as I said, the scientific novelty in it was largely in the calibration of that model to the data with the uncertainty that we have. So in that sense, yes, it can be used in the future in that the learnings from the calibration part of that model in particular can feed into more complex models that can and will be used for future pandemics like this. The underlying model, in essence, is a simple one. I suppose that's partly the beauty of it. And as Philip said, that was one of the early strategic decisions in IMAG. Do we go with a simple model or do we build an extremely complex model? But we don't know many of the things that we should be putting into that model. And that was one of the early sets of debates, I guess, we had, and one that we came down on the side of simpler models, as Philip said, which allows it to be used in the future then for that reason.
I think James might be a little bit modest as well. I think the other piece of scientific novelty was a simplification around vaccination, which was subsequently published. But like the principle, absolutely. There were some international models available that were built to be very complex and were almost experimental in nature. I think it was the right strategic decision to keep it simple. There was that a couple of important mathematical novelties in it as well, I thought. And the ability to incorporate, one of the critical decisions that government made was to be very cautious in the period that the population was being vaccinated. In other words, to say, look, we're at a particular position now. We will be better off waiting 12, 16 weeks until the majority of the population has been vaccinated than making any moves now. The economy will be fine for that kind of 12-week period. And that's a decision they could make because James very quickly adapted the model to include vaccination. And we could show them the huge impact that vaccination was likely to have on the spread of the disease. Of course, the virus later evolved to evade the vaccination when it comes to infection. So, but that was almost predictable. The trick, in a way, was getting us through to summer 2021 without a further very damaging wave of infection. So simplicity and agility were really important.
David, clearly the data is a really important element in terms of feeding into the model that James has been talking about. Can you tell us a little bit about your particular work with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic and the modelling?
My work was on collecting mobility data. I was doing this with Joey O'Brien, a former PhD student of James's, an excellent individual. And the idea of us collecting this mobility data is that if we could get at a decent proxy of how people were moving around the country, it might provide a little bit extra context for how people were adhering to the measures that were being placed in them and what was kind of happening maybe in geographical locations. So the kind of what we were collecting was kind of hopefully useful and it was very interesting. The kind of source of the data was interesting in its own right. So companies like Google and Apple were releasing aggregated versions of their location data from their customers or from their users. And they aggregated that to various levels and that was kind of open source and released to public so that they can use it to try and figure out, okay, what's happening with public mobility during COVID-19. And Joey was collecting that particular piece of data. I was collecting something a little bit different. I was collecting data to do with road traffic kind of volumes around the country. So the idea of this kind of data is that the Transport Infrastructure Ireland have a load of road counters around the country. You might have seen them, like if you're driving down a road, you might see like two little lines going across it. And when you kind of feel a little bump when you go over it. And each time you go over that, or you drive over that, it counts you as like passing that particular point in the road. And every minute of every day, they're collecting this data for the total volumes of cars passing these points. There's about 200 of these things littered around the country. And they kind of make this data available through their website. And if we can go off and find it, we can download and look at it. So went off, found it, looked at it, aggregated it to different levels. So you could say, look at the national picture to see what the total volumes over different levels of restrictions were like, say, relative to like pre-pandemic levels. Then because like they're all around the country, you can actually look at different regions as well. So like what's happening in Donegal during the summer or happening in Cork during the winter and this kind of stuff.
So just to, I'm interested in this, when you were looking at the data, was there anything that you can remember that kind of struck you? God, that's really interesting. I didn't expect to see that.
The fact that like it completely dropped off a cliff as soon as it went to kind of the first set of restrictions, like it was an abrupt change. Like it wasn't like a slowly kind of like, oh, we're going to slowly kind of like move to work from home. It's like everyone immediately kind of stayed at home. Obviously there's like, you know, essential individuals have to get to work. So there's always going to be road traffic around the country. So you can see that kind of stuff.
So just following up on that, like often you'd expect there to be a bit of a lag, wouldn't you, for people to change their behavior. Mm. Are you saying that there was no lag?
Well, you're testing my memory here, but as far as I can remember, it was pretty abrupt. Like, you know, there might have been a little bit of a lead-in period, but it wasn't like weeks, it was order of days, if anything. It was kind of interesting then around, so like at the other end, when people were kind of anticipating, say like, oh, we're going from a level zero to a level one level of restrictions, like you can see just before that came in, like the traffic volumes slowly increased. So there was actually a nice bit of information in that data that was hopefully useful to some people.
Yeah, we tracked that very closely at IMAG. So the in particular, it was important when the level of restrictions were being changed or potentially going to be changed, because the models, you know, the models aren't really predictive. The models say if people's behavior changes in the following way, this is what will likely result in terms of the R number going above or below one, or whatever else. But in order to come up with a realistic set of scenarios, we really relied heavily on data like David's and Joey's in terms of what had happened the last time restrictions changed, how fast, like you said, did people lag their behavior? Because you can't tell in advance how people are going to react to a reaction like that. And you really have to be able to deal quickly with the data as it comes in and try and understand what it might mean for the model. So it was really, really crucial part of the modeling aspects.
So sticking with this data theme, I might bring you in here at this stage, Cathal, on this one. My understanding is you use data from multiple sources. Was that tricky? I mean, I think I almost know the answer to it. It was. But, you know, can you tell us something about your work with the data, please?
Yes. So we have, ideally we get access to detailed health data. And as David's already mentioned, there are other sources like proxies on the amount of movement around the country, other proxies that we still use, like the amount of virus in wastewater, for example, sampled around the country. But at the time, we'd very little data on where the infection was and how much there was there around the place. And while there was a great desire to get access to microdata, that's the actual detail on the infections that were occurring, we know in practice from modeling work elsewhere that what we really needed was a picture of the progression of disease across the population. So we got summary data, like the number of cases that were identified per day was a good way. That was the kind of information we needed for calibrating the models. But one of the things that happened early was that the numbers looked as if they were slowing, at least the rate of increase was slowing. And so we thought maybe we were successful in our restrictions and that we'd reduced the amount of disease. But it didn't make sense that the slowing was happening as quickly. So this is where the lag that you're talking about was relevant, that there's a lag between infection and disease presentation. So we didn't expect it to slow down so quickly. And in fact, when we queried other sources, we discovered that there were a few PCR tests that were in a government jet that had gone to Germany to be read. And so, you know, Maxi's really strong on that feedback loop between the data and then the modeling and realizing, oh, well, something isn't quite right. Can we find out what's happening? And we discovered that, that indeed, yeah, there were data elsewhere that we had to bring back into our recalibration.
Thanks very much on that, Cathal. I might turn now to you, Romina. A very big theme has been data, obviously modeling and collaboration. But before this SEIR model, and you had one of the earliest papers which calibrated a different kind of model that involved maybe international collaborators. Could you tell us a little bit about that and maybe then how that is connected to, you know, to the work that went on about Maxi in the Irish context?
Yes, Selina. That collaboration actually started during my sabbatical leave in 2020 in Northern Italy. So that was between the University of Trieste, the University of Limerick, and the University of Milano. So I was there And yes.
So were you there when COVID was about to kick off in Northern Italy?
Yes, I picked my sabbatical leave. Who would have thought in 2020 in Italy, Northern Italy, actually. But so I was there. And at the time, actually, before it actually started, I was collaborating with this group of geophysicists at the University of Milano. And on the surface, you would say we were working on something completely different. We were working on imaging, actually, imaging the subsurface of the Earth. So my main expertise is inverse problems and imaging. So that's the mathematical modeling tools behind any imaging modality, from medical imaging to geophysical exploration. So we were working on that. And then you might recall how Northern Italy, in particular the Lombardy region and Milan, were hit by the pandemic. So we kind of stopped and we asked ourselves, can we use our expertise to image something different? After all, imaging is based on collecting a lot of data. Like my colleagues here and Philip Nolan earlier were mentioning all the importance of data. We had a lot of data and the daily data. And we said, okay, maybe we can do that to see the unseen. And now the unseen will be the progression of COVID. Can we get an image of how COVID is progressing? And so that's how we actually address the issue. So I would say that probably our way of seeing the problem of modeling COVID complement the work that my colleague here, James Gleason, and his collaborators have been talking about. And I guess that's a great way to look at science. You look at an issue from different point of views in a multidisciplinary way, with national and international collaboration. And this is what we do here at MACSI at the University of Limerick.
And clearly you do that really well, which brings me on to you, James Sweeney, this time. Around the same time, and in a kind of a complementary way yet again, you were a recipient of an SFI, Science Foundation Ireland, Rapid Response Grant. So can you give us an insight into what you were doing? How were you contributing to this puzzle?
Sure. The idea for that came about from probably a Maxi coffee with Kevin Burke and Fatima Juima, who was a PhD student at the time, so when it comes to disease spread, it's dictated by social interaction typically. So at the time, the government measures weren't really directed, as James Gleason mentioned earlier. The models are quite simple and don't take into account how different age strata in the population interact. So we looked at whether it was possible to incorporate social mixing. So the settings in which people mix and across age groups. And also, I suppose if you think about it, some activities are, maybe there's not as much social mixing during them, but they may generate huge economic input. So could we figure out basically the settings in which disease spreads and the economic costs associated with shutting them? And that's where Stephen Kinsler here in UL Chemie came involved. So he was focused on the economic costing of the social measures. Then the rest of us, so Kevin, Fatima, myself, Jason Wise in Trinity and Daniel Dempsey, we were looking at whether we could incorporate age structuring into the models themselves.
I like the way you introduced it and said this happened over a Maxi coffee. As per my introduction, as I said in the beginning, in Maxi, you know how to pour the perfect cup of coffee. So now, clearly, you've been very busy, but if you haven't had enough to do, I might wrap up with you, Norma. As James says, you know, you've just joined as a co-director in Maxi, so congratulations on that. It sounds really exciting. As you look to the future, what things have you planned? Where's Maxi going from here?
I think we're all really excited about what's next for Maxi. Actually, we can see that there's enormous opportunities for us across the whole group. Within Maxi itself, we've lots of expertise in things like climate modelling, health, housing, and now, of course, our expertise around pandemic response more broadly. But I suppose it's really important for us to kind of remember that we're existing as part of a much larger ecosystem, and we've seen the impact of looking outside maths and stats expertise, and you know, we've always traditionally collaborated with lots of different people, but that transdisciplinary piece is just so essential now. So from our perspective, it's really through, you know, working with others, be they our industry partners, we've involvement with national centers of excellence like Insight, Confirm, SSBC, government and community bodies, We obviously have lots of academic colleagues nationally and internationally, and Maxi alumni nationally and internationally. But it's really, I suppose, combining all of that expertise that's going to allow us to start to solve those wicked problems that Philip mentioned that are currently facing us. We're also very conscious as well around the communication piece. And as James said, we've learned a lot about how to communicate. We're trying to build that into part of the training profile that the students get, so that they can communicate those really technical details in a very simple way, or a way that will make people listen. So we're really excited about building on what we've done in the past and developing that into the future to have, I suppose, big impact in the world around us.
I would like to thank you so much for your time today. And again, warmest congratulations on your award. You've been listening to the winners of the University of Limerick President's Research Excellence and Impact Outstanding Research Collaboration Award for 2022. Today, we've listened to the contributions from Professor James Gleeson, Professor Cathal Walsh, Professor Norma Bargary, Dr. Romina Gabura, Dr. James Sweeney, Dr. David O'Sullivan, all from MACSI at the University of Limerick. We've also been joined today by Professor Philip Nolan, Chair of the Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group, IMAG, and member of the National Public Health Emergency Team and current Director General of Science Foundation Ireland. If you would like to find out more about research impact here at the University of Limerick, go to our website, ul.ie/research. The research that we've listened to today has benefited from funding from Science Foundation Ireland and the Health Research Board.